Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we open with news on redistricting maps finalized for county supervisors' districts. Find out how the changes impact East County and who's now representing you on today's show. Questions of accountability are being raised in La Mesa after a jury exonerated a police officer accused of falsifying a report and after a man who pleaded guilty to arson in burning down Chase Bank was sentenced to probation. California has a new mask mandate as the Omicron variant of COVID-19 continues to spread, and we'll have details. Lemon Grove's City Council held a contentious meeting where heated comments from the public led to two recesses, and we'll have the highlights or lowlights for you to hear on our show today. From Public News Service, we'll have some national news stories, including a call by Vice President Kamala Harris to do more to eliminate lead from drinking water, controversies over voting rights, and an update on the Violence Against Women Act in Congress, as well as a ban on some Chinese imports over human rights concerns. On the second half of our show today, we'll have some holiday fun, including our rendition of "Twas the Night Before Christmas" and all across East County, including what East County residents are asking Santa to bring. Plus, here's some holiday trivia to liven up your Yuletide conversations and learn about the De Anza Expedition's Christmas Eve in East County long ago. And finally, we'll be re-airing one of our Best of East County episodes, our interview with Don Harrison, author of Schlepping Through the American West, There's a Jewish Story Everywhere. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Effective immediately, some East County residents now have a different county supervisor. On December 15th, the San Diego County Redistricting Commission presented its final redistricting maps to the county clerk, outlining supervisorial district boundaries for the next 10 years. The biggest change impacting East County is shifting several communities out of District 2, represented by Joel Anderson, into District 4, represented by Nathan Fletcher, the current chair of the County Board of Supervisors. Areas shifted into Fletcher's district include La Mesa, Lemon Grove, Rancho San Diego, Mount Helix, and parts of Spring Valley. Fletcher's new district also includes unincorporated areas of the city of San Diego, while he loses coastal areas including La Jolla. The commission made one last-minute change to keep the city of El Cajon in District 2, Anderson's district, after earlier proposing to move it to District 4. However, some Chaldeans have objected to splitting their community between Districts 2 and 4, threatening legal action as a community of interest. District 2, Anderson's district, remains vast geographically and includes the cities of Santee, El Cajon, and Poway, as well as unincorporated areas such as Alpine, Campo, Crest, Jamul, Jacumba, Julian, Lakeside, Potrero, Ramona, and 11 Native American reservations. District 5, represented by Supervisor Jim Desmond, encompasses the north part of the county, from Oceanside and Escondido East through Santa Isabel and the desert community of Borrego Springs. It also includes several Native American reservations. District 1, represented by Nora Vargas, is now a majority Latino district that includes the cities of Imperial Beach, National City, and Chula Vista, as well as some unincorporated areas in the southwest part of the county. District 3, represented by Tara Lawson Reamer, encompasses mostly coastal areas, from Carlsbad to Coronado. Redistricting, or redrawing of voting boundaries, is done every 10 years, using U.S. Census data to ensure that voting districts contain roughly the same number of people. This was the first time that local boundaries were set by an independent commission, which is not allowed to have political considerations. The 14-member commission capped off a year of work and 49 public meetings. The commission considered four maps as it strived to address community concerns and get public input while complying with complex redistricting laws. Those laws require that districts have equal populations, but also mandate that minority voting rights be protected and communities of interest be preserved, including communities with shared economic, geographic, or cultural interests. On social media, some East County leaders and activists shared reactions to the outcome. Kathleen Coates-Hedberg, a member of the Helix Water District Board and president of the Grossmont Mount Helix Improvement Association, voiced sadness after listening to the hearing. "I will not be East County anymore," she wrote. "I love my rural community, but city close. But I guess times have changed and we are not so rural anymore." Lemon Grove Councilman Jerry Jones reflected, "It's not so much about being rural as much as being a subregion with a sense of community identity that is not swallowed up by the politics of San Diego." He drew parallels to SANDAG, where East County concerns have often been ignored by a majority controlled by San Diego and South Bay communities. Jones adds, "It's about silencing communities and securing more power for the 800-pound gorilla that is the city of San Diego." Oda Yusuf Jr., a Chaldean activist, noted that not all Chaldeans wanted to keep Rancho San Diego in East County's District 2. "I actually am in favor of keeping Rancho and El Cajon together, but I don't care whether that's in the Central District or the so-called East County District," he wrote. While many in East County had hoped to keep cities such as La Mesa and Lemon Grove in the same district with Santee, El Cajon, and rural areas, there is one potential silver lining to the changes. Formerly, East County had only two representatives on the County Board of Supervisors, meaning the majority, with mostly coastal and urban districts, could and often did outvote the East County supervisors. Now, three supervisors will have significant portions of East County in their districts, and ignoring those voices could prove politically risky at election time. Whether Supervisor Fletcher will side with San Diego interests or listen to those East County residents now in his district, at least on some issues, could prove crucial in future supervisorial decisions on everything from wildfire protection to development and transportation controversies. The maps are final, unless a lawsuit results in a court decision ordering further changes. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
On May 30th last year, racial justice protests in La Mesa were fueled in part by a viral video of a white police officer's treatment of a young black man at a trolley stop. Protests turned violent after dark, including the burning down of two banks and a historic building, actions that terrified many La Mesa residents. Officer Matt Dagis was fired from the city of La Mesa after those incidents and criminally charged for his actions. But now a jury has found Officer Dagis not guilty of falsifying a police report accusing Amari Johnson of assault. In a second controversial court case, Ricky Bernard Cooper pleaded guilty to lighting papers on fire inside Chase Bank, as well as looting businesses. Now he's been sentenced to probation only after serving 100 days in jail while awaiting sentencing. Local residents shared reactions on social media. Some worried that Cooper's light sentence for arson sent the wrong signal to future would-be rioters. Bobby Terry posted on Facebook's La Mesa Happenings forum, "Where has justice gone?" Susan Brinchman wrote, "Green light for others to do the same." But Dan T. took a different view, calling the verdict not really surprising. He believes there wasn't enough evidence that Cooper started the fire that burned the bank down, though Cooper pled guilty to setting papers on fire inside the bank and cut a deal with the prosecutor. A co-defendant is still facing charges. Cooper did, however, face repercussions after getting out of jail. On his Facebook page, he stated, "So I just got terminated from my job for people calling in and threatening to smash windows and protest outside." He later posted that he has found another job, but will not be posting the location. In a subsequent post, he observed, "Some things fall apart so better things can fall together." It all depends how you look at it. A negative mindset will never give you a positive life. We emailed La Mesa Mayor Mark Arapostathis and Councilman Jack Hsu to request comments on the Cooper sentencing. The mayor did not respond. Hsu states in part, "I know the community was deeply hurt by the burning of buildings and all the other damage which took place last year." He adds, "We, including myself, want some kind of payback to make up for the pain. Wanting every person who took part in the criminal actions of that night get arrested and having them serve long prison sentences does cross my mind from time to time. But I know it will not likely happen to many of the people responsible, and in the end, it will not undo the damage done to our city. We need to work on how we can prevent such hateful, violent, and criminal behavior in our community and society." Officer Dagis was fired by the city of La Mesa after the incident with Johnson, which occurred just days after the killing of George Floyd by a white police officer in Minneapolis, sparked racial justice protests against police nationwide, and 2 days before the La Mesa protest. A video showed Dagis pushing Johnson into a sitting position, though Dagis claimed Johnson assaulted the officer. Dagis also accused Johnson of smoking and being in an area for trolley officers only, points disputed by the prosecution. After the jury announced its not guilty verdict in the Dages trial, Tasha Williamson, an organizer of the May 30th La Mesa protest, voiced disgust but not surprise. She wrote on her Facebook page, "Matt Dages found not guilty. It was expected because he had a jury of his peers," adding that only one of the 12 jurors was a person of color. Human rights activist Mark Lane on the La Mesa Happenings Forum called the outcome a horrible verdict, but some saw things differently. Antonina Gagliano posted on Facebook, "This is not the result of a broken criminal justice system or white privilege. Matt was found not guilty because he is a police officer who did his job and acted lawfully." Gagliano called the verdict a huge win for Matt and all law enforcement in America, adding, "Furthermore, this verdict is a rejection of the anti-police movement and a step in the right direction." Glenn Grant observed Riley, "Guy who burned down bank got 2 years probation. Officer has already been punished enough and is now acquitted." District Attorney Summer Steffen issued this statement on Dages' exoneration. "While I respect the jury's verdict, I remain proud that my team courageously fought for justice without prejudice against or favor towards anyone. Civil courts may yet weigh in on the Dages-Johnson altercation, since both Dages and Johnson have filed lawsuits against the city of La Mesa. Dages' suit claims he was wrongfully terminated, while Johnson's alleges police misconduct. It remains to be seen whether La Mesa taxpayers may wind up paying financially for the actions of the city or its officer." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
Reporting for East County Magazine at KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson with a health report. All Californians are now required to wear a mask at indoor public spaces, regardless of vaccination status, under a mandate announced by the state's Department of Public Health. The new rule will remain in place until at least January 15th and follows a 47% rise in cases in the state since Thanksgiving, as well as a 14% increase in hospitalizations. In addition, the state has changed the rules for people attending mega events to require a negative PCR test 48 hours before the event or an antigen test 24 hours before the event. The state is also recommending, though not requiring, that travelers to California get a COVID-19 test 3 to 5 days after their arrival. As recently noted in an updated science brief by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, at least 10 studies have confirmed the benefit of universal masking in community-level analyses. According to the California Department of Public Health's announcement, the masking requirement in California schools has allowed us to keep schools open when compared to other parts of the country. California accounts for roughly 12% of all U.S. students, but only 1% of COVID-19-related school closures. Nationally, during the Delta surge in July and August 2021, jurisdictions without mask requirements in schools experienced larger increases in pediatric case rates, and school outbreaks were 3.5 times more likely than in areas without school mask requirements, according to the CDC. There are exceptions to the mask mandate for children under age 2, the hearing impaired, those with medical or mental disabilities for whom wearing a mask could obstruct breathing, or who are unable to remove a mask without help, and persons for whom wearing a mask would create a risk related to their work as determined by local, state, or federal regulators or workplace safety guidelines. Dr. Wilma Wooten, San Diego County's public health officer, says masks help to slow the spread of COVID-19 and its many variants. San Diegans should wear a mask while indoors in public places to protect themselves and others. In addition to wearing a mask indoors in public spaces, the following measures also help to protect against all varieties of COVID-19, including the Omicron variant. Get vaccinated and get a booster if you qualify. The vaccine is available at healthcare providers, retail pharmacies, and community clinics. You can also make an appointment or find a site near you by calling 833-422-4255. Again, that is by calling 833-422-4255 or visiting the My Turn website. Get tested if you've traveled or have any symptoms, whether you've been vaccinated or not. You can make a free test appointment or find a walk-in test clinic at coronavirus-sd.com. That's coronavirus-sd.com. Wash your hands frequently and stay home if you're sick, and distance yourself from others. More information about COVID-19 variants, testing, and vaccinations can be found at coronavirus-sd.com.
Last week, Lemon Grove small business owners Alicia and Peter Hormes were denied an off-sale alcohol permit during a tense city council meeting. Alicia Hormes pleaded as she stood at the podium facing the Lemon Grove City Council. "We want to earn your trust and to work with you every step of the way," she said, "so please give us a chance." Alicia and her spouse, Peter Hormes, have run the Discount Market convenience store on the corner of Broadway and Main Street for the past 21 years. They recently requested city permission to sell 10% of their inventory as alcohol, both to help them financially and to listen to their customers' wishes. The Planning Commission denied their request for the Conditional Use Permit, or CUP, that they needed. An appeal to the City Council was now their final option to try to win their permit. The City Council hearing ran for over 2 hours on December 7th. This format of civic proceeding transmutes the City Council into a quasi-judicial body, with the goal of hearing both sides and then voting to reach a verdict. The room was packed full of supporters of the Hormes' cause, including loyal customers, neighbors, and even their landlord. Those in attendance came with concerns about the treatment of small businesses in Lemon Grove and with the functioning of their City Council staff. Making the case for the city was Community Development Manager Noah Alvey. He emphasized a high concentration of alcohol sales in the store's census tract, 5 times the state's recommended amount, as well as an abundance of crime in the area as the reasons for the Planning Commission's original decision. He recommended that the city follow suit and uphold the first ruling. Then, both Alicia Hormes and her legal representation laid out why they should be granted the permit. They spoke of the precedence of off-sale alcohol CUPs in other highly concentrated parts of Lemon Grove, and argued that the Discount Market actually has lower than average crime rates. They also emphasized the Hormes' tenure in the Lemon Grove community as positive influences, stating that they treat customers like family and care for the homeless. In the end, the City Council upheld the Planning Commission's decision by a vote of 3-1, with Councilmember Liana LeBaron as the sole vote in favor of the Hormes'. Councilmember Jerry Jones presided over the meeting as mayor pro tem and voiced defense of his vote. He said, "If we approve this, it'll open up the floodgate. I can think of at least 4 or 5 other establishments that will come and be wanting the same things that we would give tonight." He then told the room, "We'd be going back in the things that our general plan tells us that we want. We'd be going back 30 years." However, the public in attendance staunchly disagreed with the decision. During public comment on the case leading up to the vote, many stood and voiced their advocacy, including the Hormes' landlord, Stephen Zibelman. Zibelman told council how he put faith in the couple as young, ambitious business planners over 2 decades ago, adding that he feels exactly the same now. He said, "I see no reason why we should doubt the credibility, the responsibility, and the oath that they would take to govern their business and operate it correctly and legally." He further testified, "I honestly believe that these people deserve to have this license." He continued, "I ask you to consider their application and offer them your blessing as well." 10 other individuals spoke in favor of the Hormeses, from a retired resident who relies on the safe store within walking distance, to a mother and 2 sons who travel miles out of their way to shop at the store because of the quality of care they receive, and to community members who want the Hormeses' business to benefit from new housing developments in their area. Many stressed the Hormes' willingness to change their hours or restrict the type of sales. Jessica Heredia, a Lemon Grove resident and member of San Diego's Business Improvement District, said, "I would much prefer to support the Discount Market and Peter and Alicia's family versus the big corporate chain markets like 7-Eleven." She continued, "I'm finding a pattern in Lemon Grove when it comes to small mom and pops versus big corporations. It seems it's easy for big corporations like 7-Eleven, which will get approved for the same license just 1 block away on the same street." Still, no CUP was granted for the Discount Market. Mayor Pro Tem Jones said during deliberations, "It's not easy, it's not personal, but we're here making policy." He continued, "We have to make the findings within the regulations that have been written. You can't make regulations one business at a time. The bottom line is that we have an overconcentration in the city." Jones also addressed the treatment of small businesses. He admitted some truth to the concerns, but countered by citing a Walgreens that was denied an off-sale alcohol permit just like the Hormes'. He said, There's been some allegations that we treat big boxes differently than the small stores, and I suppose there may be something to that, but I don't think it's as common as people want to think. Residents at the meeting were not only concerned with these potentially unequal policy practices. Some also expressed unease with the City Council's communication style, both between themselves and with the public. In their comments, many cited what they observed to be disrespect, lack of collaboration, and overall tension amongst the City Council members and the mayor. They called for a spectrum of changes, from better reporting to the public about staff's third-party meetings to an internal tax audit. Yet at the meeting, the public's qualms with their City Council only grew when evident tensions boiled over during the public comment of resident Chris Williams. Back-to-back recesses were called by Mayor Pro Tem Jones. On the second, he threatened to clear the room. During his allotted 3 minutes, Williams was responding to two previous speakers from regional nonprofits who told council members that alcohol increases crime and hurts children, which were the only public opinions against the Hormuzes voiced at the hearing. The second of the two used Casa de Oro, a neighborhood adjacent to Lemon Grove, in comparison with La Jolla to illustrate the point. Williams took issue with this comparison.
I'd also like to state that it's very, very hard to compare Casa de Oro to La Jolla.
Thank you.
La Jolla has resources. La Jolla has a rec center. Right? And if we want to make sure that crime is down, we should look at giving the resources to the communities. Access to alcohol is just one very, very small reason to why crime is up. That is what I've learned from the Lieutenant Sheriff himself. So if City Council would like to reduce crime, let's look at the things that the resources that are provided to this community, like a rec center. So that way our young kids and our children will be less prone to being addicted to alcohol and doing it what, like most people in La Jolla do, they use it for recreational purposes and they'll wake up and they'll be productive citizens just like most people who drink alcohol. I think it's important that Lemon Grove understands the small business community. I am a small business owner here in Lemon Grove. Jerry Jones was a small business owner here in Lemon Grove. And I think it's important that we understand that small business is the backbone of America.
Yes.
So please, the city has gotten used to finding reasons to say no, finding reasons to stonewall businesses from opening, and that increases crime. Vacant building is proven to increase crime.
Towards the end of delivering this comment, Williams felt that Mayor Pro Tem Jones was not giving his full attention, and Williams requested that he do so. This request incited both men to argue and eventually raise their voices until Jones called the first recess.
Please, if you don't mind, Jerry, when people are speaking, just to give us eye contact.
Mr. Williams, we're experiencing technical difficulties, and I'm trying to resolve them. Then don't tell me how to do my job.
I'm telling you how to do your job because I pay for you to do your job.
No, you hey, what are you speaking? Recess this
thing. Thank you.
Also, bed recess right now.
When the meeting resumed, Williams requested that he be allotted his remaining time, which he estimated to be 15 seconds. Jones moved to close the public comment portion of the hearing, to which Williams objected.
Everybody else, how come I won't get my time? Because I say something that he doesn't like?
At Jones's order, law enforcement present at the meeting confiscated the microphone from Williams. Councilmember LeBaron asked Councilmember Mendoza why they could not hear the rest of the comment. Mendoza replied,
I am tired of being yelled at by you, Mr. Williams. Please. Yeah, I do not want to listen. I've listened to you enough. Please give up the microphone. Your time was up.
As the roll was then counted to close public comment, Councilmember LeBaron leaned into her microphone.
Clerk, please take the roll. And if you have to shout over Mr. Williams, then shout over Mr. Williams.
Councilmember Mendoza? Mayor Pro Tem Jones?
Aye.
Councilmember Gastel?
Aye.
Councilmember LeBaron?
For the record, I would like to state that I believe that it is a huge abuse of your power, council members, to censor the public.
Anyone. All the speakers that Mr. Williams had his time.
You let him him off and you didn't let him get out.
You cut him off.
Another 10-minute recess, please. The next time I will clear the room.
Afterwards, the public hearing resumed and was carried out to completion, with final questioning and deliberations yielding the 3-1 verdict. The City Council functioned the way it was built to function when denying the Hormuz's appeal, not straying from the general plan nor overriding their Planning Commission colleagues, though it had the power to grant an exception. But the partnership that composes civic life between people and members of government wore thin, fueling the continued frustration of Lemon Grove's public. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
There is no reason in the 21st century for why people are still exposed to this substance that was poisoning people back in the 18th century.
Vice President Kamala Harris stopped by the Washington, D.C. headquarters of the AFL-CIO on Wednesday to unveil a new lead pipe and paint action plan. As part of that plan, the EPA is allocating $3 billion for lead pipe replacement efforts in 2022. Long-term, the initiative calls for replacing all of the nation's lead lines in the next decade. Harris calls it a job creator.
When union jobs are safer, our communities are safer. And when union members go to work, they go to work for all of us.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is pushing back on Democrats' plans to pass new voting rights legislation by year's end. The Hill reports the Dems are looking at altering the Senate's filibuster rules to break a months-long stalemate on the issue.
My colleagues across the aisle have pushed absurd bills that would do things like neuter voter ID laws, make every state legalize ballot harvesting, turn the Federal Election Commission into a biased partisan body, and even send taxpayer money to political campaigns.
Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar argues that Republican-controlled states have restricted voting access since the 2020 presidential election. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, as of early October, 19 states this year had adopted laws making it harder for folks to cast their ballots.
The Constitution anticipated that perhaps we would need a federal response when, in the words of the Constitution, as written by our founding fathers, that Congress can make or alter the rules regarding federal elections.
It's not all partisan gridlock, though. The Senate has unanimously passed a bill effectively banning imports from China's Xinjiang region, where the government is accused of forcing members of China's Muslim minority into labor camps. The act would only allow imports from the region if customs officials can prove the goods were made without the use of slave labor. And a bipartisan coalition of lawmakers has finalized a proposal to update the 1994 Violence Against Women Act. California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein says the new version would extend numerous services to survivors of domestic violence.
Our agreement would also invest in prevention education efforts. It would expand access to emergency housing support for domestic violence supporters, and it would improve the healthcare response to sexual violence across the country.
Finally today, President Joe Biden signed a measure posthumously awarding the Congressional Gold Medal to the 13 U.S. service members who lost their lives during the Afghanistan evacuation in August. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea. Public interest news for our region.
'Twas the night before Christmas in all o'er East County. Not a creature was stirring from Borrego to El Monte. Hiking boots were hung by chimneys with care in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. From Verona to Ramona, Hakumba to Hamul, East County residents this 2021 Yule celebrate the season with favorite dishes and, since Santa Claus, these holiday wishes. Descanso residents ask Santa to stop SDG&E from turning off power whenever it's windy. Borrego Springs folks wish for a whole lot of rain, while the Masons want burned banks to build back again. Chamber of Commerce leaders ask Santa to axe Sandag's dreaded mileage tax. Grossmont Hospital's doctors want vaccines for all. Parkway Plaza seeks holiday jingle for them all. Out in Lake Morena, all want water that's drinkable. After months of bottled water, a plight that's unthinkable. Many East County folks want to lose quarantine girth. Afghan refugees in El Cajon just want peace on earth. Lemon Grove folks seek help for those on the street. Santee wants widening Highway 52 to be complete. Alpine wants redistricting to keep East County together and not split communities that are birds of a feather. Lakeside and Spring Valley ask Santa to deliver a halt to sand mining plans for their rivers. Teachers want support for school academics, while parents ask Santa to end the pandemic. Julian wants tourists to finally return, while Cal Fire asks that no wildfires burn. Ramona's wineries ask Santa to bring them good cheer, with lots of new visitors in the new year. While most folks are snuggled all warm in their beds, East County's homeless want roofs over their heads. On sidewalks and in riverbeds in their stocking caps, they tried settling down for cold winter's naps. When up in the sky there arose such a clatter, they sprang to their feet to see what was the matter. Away to the tent flaps they flew like a flash, tore open the front flaps, and out they did dash. The moon on the breast of the sidewalks below gave the luster of midday to objects aglow, when what to their wondering eyes should appear but a magical sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer, with a little old driver so lively and quick they knew in a moment it must be Saint Nick. Beside wild turkeys and eagles, his reindeer they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donder and Blitzen, to the top of the hill, then the new border wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away, aw! As dry leaves that before Santa Ana winds fly, when they meet with an obstacle mount to the sky, so in through the treetops the coursers they flew, with the sleigh full of gifts and St. Nicholas too. And then in a twinkling they heard a dog woof. At the prancing and pawing of each little hoof, as they drew in their heads and were turning around, down St. Nicholas came to their camp with a bound. He was dressed in faux fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of gifts he had flung on his back, and he looked like a homeless man opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry, his cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth had a mask with a bow, and the beard on his chin was as white as the snow. An Indian peace pipe he held tight in his teeth, and its smoke encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like Julian apple jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, so all laughed when they saw him in spite of themselves. A wink of his eye and a nod of his head soon gave them to know they had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but turned with a jerk, filling wishes for food, good health, and work. Then he doled out toys, books, and clothes, and giving a nod to the heavens he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down on a thistle. But all heard him exclaim ere he drove out of sight, "Merry Christmas, East County, and to all a good night."
This is Miriam Raftery, and I'm here with John Fastier. This holiday season, if you're looking for some safe conversation topics to liven up your next gathering with friends and family without bringing up politics, here are some fascinating holiday trivia facts to share.
Candy canes are stocking stuffer traditions, but they were actually invented to keep children quiet during church.
In medieval times, the main dish served at Christmas dinners was peacock, not turkey.
Jingle Bells was originally written for Thanksgiving, not Christmas.
Christmas trees were once considered pagan symbols, but today 350 million of them are grown on Christmas tree farms in the U.S., where 98% of all Christmas trees sold are now sustainably raised. A Christmas tree grows for 15 years on average before it is cut.
The world's tallest snowman was actually a snow woman, standing over 122 feet tall. She was built by townspeople in Bethel, Maine, with wreaths as eyes, skis for eyelashes, tires as buttons, and trees for her arms.
According to the Bible, magi, also known as wise men, brought gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh to the Christ child born in a manger. The term magi derives from ancient Greece and Persia, where it meant magicians or astronomers.
The magi reportedly followed the Star of Bethlehem. To this day, scientists are not sure what that star was. Possibly a conjunction of two planets, a comet, a supernova, or something else that lit up the sky.
The first electric Christmas lights to light up the sky were invented by Thomas Edison.
Hanukkah is also called the Festival of Lights. A menorah is lit for 8 nights and traditionally placed in a window to remind the outside world of the miracle of oil that burned for 8 days after rededication of a temple in Jerusalem.
Originally, the only Hanukkah gifts were small amounts of money known as gelt, a tradition that was designed to teach children the importance of charity.
The first Hanukkah party in the White House was hosted by President George W. Bush, a tradition that continues to this day.
The most popular Christmas song of all times, White Christmas, was written by Irving Berlin, a Jewish songwriter.
Americans spend 6 times more on gifts than food during the holiday season, but they are also more apt to donate to charities at this time of year.
Santa Claus would have to travel at over 5 million miles per hour in order to deliver presents to all of the children on Earth in a single night.
The tradition of making New Year's resolutions was started by the ancient Babylonians, who actually celebrated the New Year in springtime. The most common resolution was to return borrowed farm equipment.
Roman Emperor Julius Caesar established the Julian calendar that we use today, with January 1st as the first day of the new year.
Today, the most common resolution is to lose weight. Not surprising, since the average Christmas dinner in America contains over 7,000 calories.
Dropping a ball in Times Square to ring in the new year began in 1907 because fireworks had been banned as too dangerous. The ball has been a New Year's tradition ever since, except in 1942 and 1943 when it was canceled due to wartime restrictions.
The first ball was made of iron and wood, adorned with 100 light bulbs. It weighed 700 pounds. Nowadays, the ball weighs nearly 12,000 pounds and shimmers with 2,668 Waterford crystals.
All year long, visitors to Times Square in New York City write their New Year's wishes on pieces of confetti. At the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve, those wishes are included in over a ton of confetti that showers the crowd gathered to ring in the new year. And now from all of us at East County Magazine, to all of you, we wish you a very Merry Christmas, joyous Hanukkah, and a Happy New Year. On December 24th, back in 1775, Juan Bautista de Anza's colonizing expedition from Spain spent the night in Coyote Canyon, an area that's now part of the Anza Borrego Desert in Borrego Springs. Writer Dick Overturf penned these words about that ordeal. It was Noche Buena, Christmas Eve, in Anza's camp. It was cold, foggy, and rainy. Earlier, it had been snowing. Everyone and everything was wet. Babies were crying. Women were weeping. Dead cattle lay on the ground. Hundreds of horses, mules, burros, and cattle were milling around Maria Gertrudis Rivas, who was in labor. Few could sleep, and the mountain Cahuilla Indians were watching. Who were these intruders? The soldiers and settlers in De Anza's expedition had been on the march north from Mexico for 87 days when they reached Coyote Canyon, seeking the promised land at Mission San Gabriel. An earthquake struck that night also, rattling the group's composure amid the bitter cold. After Friar Pedro Font recited evening prayers or vespers, Colonel Anza distributed a potent brandy drink, aguardiente, to raise his soldiers' morale. Friar Font took offense, declaring that it is not right to celebrate the birth of the infant Jesus with drunkenness, to which De Anza replied, I do not give it to them to get drunk. He insisted that the king had ordered the brandy for the soldiers, but warned that if any soldier was found drunk outside his tent, he would be punished. Friar Font later reported that the people that night were so noisy, singing and dancing from the effects of the liquor, not caring that we were in so bad a mountain in the rain, and so delayed with the saddle animals and tired cattle, but such is the rule of those absolute lords. This was not the first time Friar Font had scolded the expedition's commander. Just 1 week earlier, a fandango, or jubilant dance and feast, was held. The fandango at San Felipe, said Font, was somewhat discordant, and a very bold widow who came with the expedition sang some verses which were not at all nice, applauded and cheered by all the crowd. Now, at the Christmas Eve encampment in Coyote Canyon, after the celebration died down, the friar comforted a soldier's wife who had been in labor since the day before. She was fearful of dying, and I consoled her as best I could, he wrote. Shortly before midnight on Christmas Eve, the soldier's wife gave birth to a baby boy, who was christened Salvador Ignacio Linares. He was the third child born on the expedition and the first white child born in California. A monument honoring the baby's birth on the eve of the Nativity still stands today, about 2.25 miles from Anza Ridge, near the San Diego County line. The day after the child's birth, the weary band of travelers rested before continuing on their way. Father Font delivered a sermon and then wished them all Feliz Navidad, or Merry Christmas. Next up, we're going to be re-airing one of our Best of East County segments, author Don Harrison on his book about schlepping across the West and finding a Jewish story everywhere.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Don Harrison, author of Schlepping Through the American West, There's a Jewish Story Everywhere. My guest, a seasoned journalist, is also editor and publisher of San Diego Jewish World, an online newspaper that serves the San Diego Jewish community and serves Jews around the world. So welcome, Don. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Raina, for having me.
Let's start with your history. I know that since 1986, you've been writing Jewish stories about events, people, and places not only in San Diego, but in the rest of the country and the world. How did you get started writing Jewish stories?
Well, I had been a journalist before. I had been the political writer for the San Diego Union. And then I got into public relations and found myself missing journalism. About the same time, my daughter, Sandy, had her bat mitzvah. And I had come from a family that wasn't all that involved with the Jewish community, and I never had a bar mitzvah as a kid. And they have a ceremony where they pass down the Torah from generation to generation. And as I watched it go briefly into my arms and then to her arms, I thought, wow, she's inherited a heritage that I don't have. I want to learn more about this. And I thought, well, I'm a reporter, I'm a journalist. The best way I can learn is if I start writing stories about the Jewish community. And I volunteered to write stories for one of the Jewish newspapers, the San Diego Jewish Press Heritage, which ultimately I became the editor-in-chief and later the publisher of.
And do you remember your first Jewish story?
Yes. Actually, it was a trialogue among three rabbis from the different movements. One was a rabbi from the Orthodox Beth Jacob. His name was Rabbi Langer. The other one was a rabbi from the conservative Tiferet Israel, and that was Aaron Gold. And the third one was from the Reform congregation Temple Emmanuel, and that was Rabbi Marty Lawson. And they held forth about the differences among the movements, and it ran as a front-page story, not in the Heritage. This was before I started with the Heritage. It was in the competitive paper, which was then called, I think, San Diego Israel Today or something like that.
Okay, so later, you fell in love with writing those stories.
Yeah, it was great. It really was. And ever since, I've always looked for Jewish angles to stories. And as a regional newspaper might ask for what's the El Cajon angle or the East County angle, I ask what's the Jewish angle.
Well, in Schlepping Through the American West, you and your grandson go on a 3,600-mile round-trip odyssey from San Diego to Alberta, Canada, discovering Jewish stories and links. How did that trip get started, and why the American West?
Well, I think it's kind of fascinating that here in San Diego, we have two northbound interstate freeways that actually cross, I-5, which goes north along the coast, and I-15. And I thought, well, that makes for an interesting route, wouldn't it, if you were to go up the I-15 all the way to Canada and then perhaps across and then come down to the 5 and end up at the same place. And I don't know why I became fixated on that, but I thought, gee, that would be a fun trip. And I asked Shore if he would like to go with me and see what we could find. And Shore's my grandson, and he said yes.
So when you took this trip, did you have it preset where you'd go or how you would dig up these stories, or was that spontaneous?
Well, it was a little of each. In some cases, we actually wrote ahead and knew that we wanted to go there and hoped that we could arrange interviews. In other places, it was just serendipitous. For example, one story I wrote was at an Indian reservation, the Blackfoot Indian Reservation. We went into a trading post. I happened to pick up a book there that was written by one of the members of the Blackfoot Indians, and found it so fascinating that I decided to devote a column or a story to that.
And you found a Jewish angle for that.
Well, the Jewish angle was the comparison, because they believe that, for example, mice can talk. They don't necessarily believe, but in their legends, the mice talk. And they also have ceremonies where they have their tobacco pipe and they wave it in the directions of the four directions and up and down. Uh-huh. And I found similarities to Judaism in that. We have in Judaism in the Torah, the story of a donkey who was carrying a passenger and is stopped by an angel of the Lord and won't move. And the fellow riding him starts whacking him. And the donkey looks up and says, "Why are you hitting me? You know, haven't I always been good?" And so it's not all that amazing to have a story about a talking animal in a religious text. And similarly, we have a ceremony in Judaism where we wave our lulavs during the holiday of Sukkot and to the different directions. So it was a nice place to find a comparison.
Interesting. So the book is both a guidebook and it's a collection of tales. Could you share with us right now a little bit of your favorite tale?
Well, I don't know if it's my favorite.
What are your favorites?
One of my favorite. But one of the places that we went to was in Idaho. Remember, we're going along the Interstate 15, and we found out that the town of Blackfoot, Idaho, had the Potato Museum.
Okay.
And we thought, gee, what? That would be interesting, uh-huh. Potato Museum. So I'll start a little bit of it. About the time that movie star Marilyn Monroe converted to Judaism in association with her marriage to playwright Arthur Miller, potato farmers and marketers in Idaho were talking about how beautiful a woman she was. Quote, "She's the kind of woman who would look good in anything, even a potato sack," said one. "Say, that's a brilliant idea," said another. "Let's see if we can get her to pose for our advertising campaign." They did, and she did, producing a memorable image of Monroe in a burlap bag. As was clear to everyone, she was outstanding in her field. The joke there being that she's standing in a potato field.
Oh, the Monroe, I didn't even get that. I got it now. Thank you.
The Monroe image is just one of the exhibits of the Idaho Potato Museum, which shares crowded quarters in a former railroad depot with the Blackfoot Chamber of Commerce. Here one can learn about the history of the Idaho potatoes, as well as about some of the innovations that have changed the way potatoes are planted and harvested. There are also interesting potato-based collections, such as postage stamps from around the world, featuring potatoes or their lore, an assemblage of Mr. Potato Head toys, and a one-of-a-kind souvenir, a potato signed by former U.S. Vice President Dan Quayle.
Oh, wonderful. It was really fun to read.
Do you remember Dan Quayle and his famous potato gaffe, and he wanted to put an extra E on it?
Yes.
So that's why they got him to sign the potato, and he was a good enough sport to do it.
Great. I know that one of your readers, Rabbi Ben Kamen, mm-hmm. he called you not only the ultimate wandering Jew, but he said you're a highly valued wondering Jew. What other topics besides the themes that you've mentioned, potatoes and history, what other topics do you wonder about in Schlepping Through the American West? What topics do you think are relevant to everyone, no matter what their faith is?
Well, I think most of them are. There were perhaps one or two stories that you might say were almost exclusively Jewish. I dealt with mm-hmm. a Jewish synagogue, obviously, and a Jewish cemetery in two different chapters. But the rest of them really were about Americana. Mm-hmm. And I look at these stories as tapestries, and through these tapestries there might be a Jewish thread here and there. I try to focus on the Jewish thread, but as well to tell the story of the place. So, for example, we went to the Buffalo Preserve up in Montana, the Bison Preserve, I should say properly, because mm-hmm. they aren't really buffaloes. And talked about how Theodore Roosevelt was involved in the conservation of these incredible creatures who were slaughtered, unfortunately, during the 19th century and who mm-hmm. faced extinction. And told about what the experience is like to drive through the National Bison Range and to see these creatures and have them come right up to your car. And at the same time, wove through it the interesting fact, at least to me, that Moise, M-O-I-E-S-E, is the name of the town that the National Bison Range is in. And, of course, I drew the conclusion that Moise was a biblical name or from Moses, and found out that it was actually the name of the Native American who owned the area and who had been given his name by a church. And so my conclusion actually worked out that there was this Jewish thread running through it. And I talked about Theodore Roosevelt and Moses both being conservationists. And there's a famous Jewish story, we call him Midrashim, about Moses who had a sheep that wandered away from the flock. And he followed the sheep, and he found the sheep drinking from the water. And he realized that the reason that the sheep had left was because he was so thirsty, and he felt sorry for the sheep. And so when he retrieved him, instead of being angry at him, he put him on his shoulders and he carried him back to the flock. And according to the story, God saw this, and he says, if he treats the sheep so well, he'll also treat the Israelites well, and he'll be the leader. And so these kinds of stories, you try to weave together as you go to places that are of general sightseeing interest.
It really does sound like a tapestry.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to the global stage for a moment. I know a very hot topic. In any way, does all the unrest and violence in the Middle East affect your writing, your perspective, anything that you're doing?
It's an interesting question. When I say in the subtitle of the book that there's a Jewish story everywhere, I have, you might say, three reasons why I'm able to say that. Israel is one. I mean, everybody in the world, every country in the world, either has relations or refuses to have relations with Israel. And so that offers one, you might say, possible range of stories. And the other two kinds of stories is the Bible, which I've just mentioned. The Hebrew scriptures are known throughout the world and, sure. and so forth. And the third thing is that Jews have been a very peripatetic people. We traveled everywhere to a large degree because we were merchants and we would open up new trade routes and open up stores and so forth. And so you can always find from those three themes some sort of a story. And occasionally the story may well be about Israel. In fact, let's see, I guess it's in Rancho San Diego, or El Cajon, I guess, is this big skyline church. And if you go there, I mean, they're very Israel-oriented. They have a wall inside their atrium that looks like the Kotel, the Wailing Wall, or the Western Wall of Jerusalem, where parishioners can stick notes into it, and they have two big pillars in that atrium that are supposed to be the pillars of Solomon. And it's an example of how important those scriptures are, not only to Jews, but to the Western religions.
Wonderful. You really have a lot to show us that's already been there, and we haven't looked at it quite that way. How about East County? Are there any stories that particularly focus in East County that you'd like to share with us?
Well, just briefly, there are some that I've always enjoyed. In La Mesa, for example, one of the landmarks there is Mount Nebo. And, of course, in the Bible, Mount Nebo was the place where Moses looked out over the promised land and then died, and he wasn't allowed to actually go to the promised land. I always wondered about that name, like, gee, you get to look out, but you don't get to come down the mountain. But I guess the developers were thinking about the other Israelites who would actually go into the promised land and had a great view of it.
So La Mesa is the promised land.
Well, they were, as far as the developers, there was a fellow named Sherman Grable, who was a Methodist, and he used that metaphor. In Santee, at the Santee Lakes, it's one of my favorite places to go walking, and I draw inspiration from the way the different species get along. I have pictures of pelicans and cormorants sharing the same rock, and pictures of egrets and herons fishing from the same shore, and an osprey and another egret up in the same tree. And so you get this sort of sense of a multiculturalism at the Santee Lakes. And yet at the same time, you also see flocks of ducks together, of mud hens together. And so they have their separate cultures, but they also mingle together. And I think of that as a metaphor.
Yeah, I love that metaphor.
And then finally in Lakeside, the old Lakeside hotel was at one point owned by, the whole rancho was owned by Adolph Levi, who was a fellow in Julian who, if you ever go to the Julian drugstore, there's a plaque on the drugstore that it was once owned by him. But he also purchased land, and so that area was owned by the Levi family. And so it's just another strand that runs through these tapestries.
Great. Thanks for sharing those.
Sure.
Interesting. One last question. What are you writing next? Will it be more travels from a Jewish American grandfather, or will it be something entirely different?
Well, I have another book that I'm collating now. It's called Schlepping Over the High Seas.
Okay, and more schlepping.
I've done a lot of cruising, and just as I have done in the American West, whenever I get to a port, I try to find the Jewish story. And, of course, there are many Jewish stories on the ships. And so, these are tapestries. They are stories about cruising, about the kinds of people you might meet on a cruise ship, about places you might go or the cruise ship might take you. But I always try to find that little Jewish thread within those stories.
And when do you think it'll be available?
Well, I'm guessing sometime next year. It's a matter now of pulling stories from, I've been a journalist for over 50 years, and I'm trying to go back and to find some of those stories that meet the theme. And that takes a little while, and maybe I'll go on a cruise or two between now and then.
Oh, you'll have to go on a cruise. Well, we look forward to seeing it. Our time is up, Don, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I greatly enjoyed the interview.
For more information on Don Harrison and his work, please visit sdjewishworld.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea. Public interest news for our region.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show. A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region. Please support KNSJ by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org.